In summer, they announced that their new programming language, Swift. Something like that. Apple.
How is it? For the iPhone?
Well, they intended to be used for all, developing all their applications on platforms as well.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who started the Clam project is the one behind that. So he uses LLB as a backend as well.
Wow. What's the odds of that happening?
Well, Clam is a default compiler in Apple. If you run GCC, it's actually a link to Clam.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Didn't know that.
Yeah,
interesting.
It's a very mature compiler now.
Hmm.
Apple uses it to compile all their software.
That's interesting. Okay, so let's get started on the updates maybe first, and then we can talk about the software that we got access to, it seems. Some of it.
Yacht?
Yacht is not available publicly, that's what I'm doing. And we are not going to get it. Because it depends on some sort of hypervisor that is not public either. So we can't get HyperSim, so we can't get either of them for our work. I've told them to let us know if that changes. But what we do have is the VM emulation platform, where we have latencies that are supposedly equivalent to persistent memory. That's what we get.
It's not that exciting.
Huh?
It's not that exciting.
It's not that exciting, but at least we'll have a more believable evaluation if we get to use that platform. Do you have access to that node, by the way?
I think so.
That machine has the kernel that... that is compiled to emulate the persistent memory latencies. We can talk about that later. Let's do the updates first.
Sure.
So, Daniel, maybe you should get started.
So... from CMake, I went to C-Test, which is just trying to input, make all the tests that Leo coded up into CMake, and they should be able to run through C-Test, and we should be able to check whether if anything breaks while running them or not,
mm-hmm.
and I should be able to get that done by today.
So, I mean, I'm not very familiar with how CMake and C-test work. So are you saying that you are able to compile the project using CMake and compile all the tests as well?
Yes.
Using CMake. Now the C-test is actually launching those tests automatically?
Yes.
So each time you compile, the C-test also gets executed and...
I'm sure you can... it depends on how you write the CMake. We can write it like that, but... or we can just have it so that if you write it... you run the test by command, you get a C-test.
Okay. So you can set it up that way. Okay. Right, good. So it seems like he's done, more or less. Isn't it true?
Well, once I finish with C-test, sure. I mean, I can still beautify CMake a little bit.
Mm.
Make it be a little better. Which I will do, but after that...
That's good. That's good news. So, I guess we should probably talk about what comes up next, because I'm assuming that C-test is going to be done pretty soon. Is that right?
Yeah.
But, okay. So, what comes up next for Daniel? According to you?
I think the next logical step would be to get involved in the actual test, to modify them so that we can automate the test of the project. Potentially change those or start adding new ones.
With the goal of, what would be the goal for that piece of work?
I think that there are a couple of objectives that I have in mind.
Hmm.
We want to have more tests to, I think the CTEST platform also does analysis like code coverage to make sure that add new tests to verify the correctness of the implementation. And also, by doing so, he gets an introduction to how to the internals of the library. Because what we're going to be testing is not just the API, but also has dedicated tests for specific parts of the library. So we can dissect it and say, we have these metadata structures, let's write tests for this one now. Understand how it works, what it's supposed to do. And then the next. I have that for a couple, but not all of them. So I think it's a more gentle bi-part introduction, part-by-part introduction to the actual library.
Okay, I see. Okay, well, that sounds like a significant amount of work. So when you were talking about your original plan to finish the C-test, you were just talking about automating C-test using the tests that already are implemented.
Okay. Just telling C-tests, like, these are the tests, and this is how the output should be, and that's it, which can be done in a few lines for each test.
And C-test will automatically check for whether the output spec is being met
right.
by those executions and all that.
It could do, like, it could check regular expressions of the output to check against to see whether it's correct or not, but Leo's saying we just want to see if they run or not, so that's even easier.
Hmm.
That might require doing some change in the test to modify the output so that it is always in standard one.
Okay.
As opposed to print out just the performance numbers, or the ones that are measuring performance, also verify that the output is correct. So that the test is as simple as verifying that the program executed to completion. Right? Something like that. Because I don't think we don't care for now about the performance.
So some tests don't finish running, they keep going, is what you're saying?
Well, maybe something happened in the middle, and you return something that is an error. So
right.
The test didn't finish the completion.
Okay.
Right? In a program, typically,
it'll finish, though, except with an error.
Right, but if you finish with an error, then the exit code is an error.
Right. No,
but are there tests which run infinitely, is what you're asking?
Yes.
Hmm.
No. We don't have any tests that run infinitely.
Yeah, as long as they stop, CME can tell you, okay, there it was an error code or not, basically.
Hmm. Okay. So then, for Daniel to be able to create any additional tests, he would need to understand at least what the API is and how.
True.
The library API. So that's a good start for you.
Okay.
I mean, start by learning the API of the library, write a few simple tests. And these tests may not eventually make it to the CMake tests, but at least you'll have a good sense for how the library works.
Okay.
And then, you know, once you have one or two of those simpler tests written out, then we could talk about specifying others.
Right.
In a more systematic fashion. Yeah? Is that something?
Yeah. I'm sure that once we start testing things that are more complicated, you're going to start finding some funky errors.
Yeah.
And then things are going to get really interesting.
But are you able to execute any tests yet?
Yeah.
You are. So you have... you have a machine set up to be able to run those. Is the virtual machine or a real machine?
No, I run the one in the lab. I have an account.
Okay.
Machines.
So doesn't running those tests require a dedicated device or a partition?
No.
Is
it's just
a file
and a file system.
Okay. That's good because at some earlier version we needed a device partition, but then we realized that a file is as good as that, right?
Well, in SoftPM, we use a device also for performance.
Yeah.
But in this new one, if we want to get performance, we have
to install the PMFS file. And it might be a good idea for him to go through that process as well on his machine, wherever he's testing.
There are figure there are two ways to do that. One is using a virtual machine. The problem with PMFS is that you basically have to compile and install a kernel, which is not that difficult to do. Ideally, you want to do that in a physical machine. You just want to have a kernel that you boot into.
That PMFS kernel that they're giving us access to, which simulates the PM latencies, I don't think that is public.
I think what simulates that is not part of PMFS. It's part of some other infrastructure. The PMFS is not even aware of that. It just experiences the latencies, but it's part of some other code base and everything.
I'm wondering how, well, maybe you should talk about that later on. Wondering how we're going to make use of that stuff. I mean, how do we run that? Because there's probably a whole bunch of people using that same machine.
And the funny part is that before you run your test, you have to run some scripts to configure, saying this is the latency that I want to run my experiment on.
Then everyone sees that.
Yes.
So, I don't get it. There must be some kind of a scheduling mechanism besides just saying, okay, here's a machine. Do your stuff on it.
When I was using it?
If no one is using it, that's fine. I mean, if it's dedicated.
No, but I used it when I was in Intel. Because that was the only machine that had that infrastructure.
And you never know who's changing the configuration behind your
while
you're running your experiment.
I'm going to use it. I didn't even check if there was something else logging. It's like, this is the latency that I want, and now I'm going to run my experiments. And is there someone else running? Good luck to them.
Well, good luck to you.
And me as well, yeah.
No, that doesn't make much sense. I don't know why they're doing it this way.
Probably there are not many people with access to that machine.
Well, anyway,
at least we're in a different time zone than they are. So. Wake up early in the morning.
Yeah.
Or have a script that like runs it. But, like,
well, yeah, they must be thinking about the same thing, right?
So.
Okay. Sorry, I was just looking at the news. They have two new iPhones. Which is what I guess everyone thought. Anyway. Alright, so... So Daniel, are your next steps then clear to you?
So, the way I see it, get to know the API, get to, try to implement my own small tests as a learning process, and then get to know, see if I can talk to Leo then about where to go from there. Probably he wanted to create other tests.
I think you should do that after you finish automating the tests that we have already.
Okay. Yeah. No, that should be done today.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Okay, good. So, Leo, what's going on with your stuff?
Right, well, the only significant update was the test that I sent you and we shared with that guy. I don't know, we haven't received anything back.
I haven't heard anything back from him yet.
Right. I went through the code again. I didn't see anything wrong. I did verify the assembly code that code generates. Seems okay to me.
Okay. Now, let's say that we're going to show both this new version of CLFlush and the original version of CLFlush, and maybe we're doing something wrong with the emulation, which hopefully we'll get to hear about eventually. Let's say that's going to be sorted out. What is the next step?
I think we should start implementing the discovery.
Okay.
I don't see why not.
Okay, so to implement discovery, do we create any additional ordering points? I guess that's the first question.
It's I don't know.
So what do we do currently? when there is a checkpoint.
When there's a checkpoint?
A sync point.
Okay. When there's a checkpoint, well, at that point, you should have some data pages that have been copied.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that you also have some metadata pages that have been copied. And potentially many pointers in the DRAM buffer. The location of many persistent pointers being stored in DRAM.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing that you do, it's you walk through the tree and you start merging the data pages. Basically,
when don't you have to first?
Well, the first thing is setting the flag and saying I'm starting a point.
Mm.
There's a couple of operations that before and after you have to flush the entire cache.
Mm.
And then that's the logic. I think initially you go and make all the pointers that you have cached. You put in the persistent list.
I see. Now, okay, maybe this happens later. Why don't you continue?
Okay. So you move the pointers to the persistent list, and then you start walking through the tree, merging the pages.
Okay, I think it needs to happen earlier. What stops the persistent the list from growing while you're doing this?
What list?
The list of pointers. You're moving the list of pointers into the persistent list, right?
Yes.
The locked pointers. But that might grow. If you have multiple threads, for instance.
That is true. Yeah. Everything is single thread now, it's not thread safe.
Okay. Let's say we want to provide multi-threading support. Then we have to stop other threads from making any progress. So before we start moving pointers,
do we want to do that?
Hmm?
Do we want to stop the world to do that?
Otherwise, your list of pointers is going to keep growing, isn't it?
True. But that might be okay. As long as I know exactly. It's possible to say, okay, I have a mark saying this is the last point. Last point that belongs to this. And let it keep growing.
So that approach would require the application to synchronize its own threads itself, its threads itself, because if one of the threads issues a C point and other threads are changing the state of the persistent container, actually it doesn't make sense for the application to do that. So maybe it's the responsibility of the application to not modify the container while one of the threads is taking a checkpoint.
Okay.
So yeah, that's good. So I think we can make the assumption that the application is not going to change the state of the container until the C point returns. But after the C point returns, all bets are off.
About this, why don't we just start with something more concrete?
Hmm.
Why don't we identify what type of multi-thread application we want to support first? And then I can implement a toy application that does the same thing and build support for that. Maybe something like you could produce a consumer or any
mm-hmm.
other type of multi-thread application.
Yeah, so for instance, a graph analytics application. One thread produces the graph, the other thread analyzes the graph. Or collaborative. But there's only one writer in that situation.
The problem about the graph example is that I have to graph, or write the graph and the analysis of the graph myself, or use a library.
Hmm.
Which means that I have to understand where in the library I have to insert pointer at.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking aloud in terms of what kind of applications would probably use something like this, right?
Oh, I see.
Not necessarily saying that you should be writing those applications. Because, I mean, even to come up with an existing application that could make use of support like that, where there are multiple threads manipulating the same data structures in some sort of cooperative way, otherwise it doesn't make much sense.
You just want a simple program?
Hmm?
A simple program? Maybe just a prime number checker?
You need some data structures, right? There have to be some data structures. So for instance, you could have, I mean, here's one possibility. Let's say I have 100 cores, and I want to write an application that searches through, I want to write an indexing application. So a really large document. So if I'm able to chop pieces of the document, hand it to each thread, and then each thread can go ahead and parse through this document, creating an index, basically a hash table of various words that show up in the document. Right? Make sense?
No, we can do something as simple as a merge sort.
A merge sort.
With multi-threads.
Hmm.
Right? Okay. Similar to what you're describing. Imagine they have a big file,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like a merge sort. You have each thread reading a portion of the file,
mm-hmm.
you sort that, and then you merge it, divide it again, sort that, and merge. It's like similar to...
that sounds reasonable. Yeah, you'll have to have two threads, but you don't have two threads working on the same job. Each thread works on separate things, and you have one thread working on the...
The merging part is the one that needs to be coordinated.
But that's done by only one thread, isn't it? You know, that's sort of... Maybe if you make a parallel merge sort, then yes.
That's what I mean, right? A parallel merge sort.
Hmm. A parallel merge sort, how does that work? How does the parallel merge sort work? That two threads are...
So you have multiple threads reading off different assets in the file, and then they have internal buffer, and they have to sort, and then you merge every two of them. You go to the next level and do the same thing, and the buffer keeps drying and drying.
Who does the merging? One thread or two threads?
Potentially, you do multiple merges at the same time.
By multiple threads or a single?
By multiple threads. But it's completely disjoint, the data structure is disjoint. So you don't need any locking there.
I don't know, but yeah, that's what I was wondering. So, but the other example that I was thinking about is a single index with multiple threads are updating.
Single index, multiple threads.
So if you have a really large document,
right?
1 terabyte document, you have 100 cores, you split it up into 100 gigabyte documents, and each thread is creating an index, but it's one big giant index that they are all writing into at the same time. It's not an application that we know right away, but it's an indexing. It's a distributed or parallel indexing application. And this could be thought of as a MapReduce job, where you split it up into multiple stages. That's also possible.
So this is the multiple, just to have multiple writers.
Multiple writers, exactly. Creating one giant index, and it makes sense to create this index in persistent memory with some additional persistent state where each thread can get started from where it left off. Right, if there is a failure.
And we want from the perspective of application then the sync operation to be blocking and atomic.
Yeah. You have only one thread doing the sync operation.
Periodically. Oh, we could use the red-black tree that we have among other statistical performance.
Mm-hmm.
That should be, we could use that for indexing.
Indexing, yeah.
And
but then you'll need some additional locks and things like that to update the index.
Yeah, we need a lock in the tree. At least
but
one lock
like
in
one
the tree.
One giant lock for the whole tree. Yeah, that would slow things down significantly. But let's say that we do it that way. Then we have the multiple writers. I mean,
either that, or we could have, if we're concerned about the big lock slowing things down, we can have as many trees as CPUs.
But then those trees are disjoint.
Yes.
Those trees are disjoint.
Which may be fine.
Would be your concern about having duplicates?
There would be duplicates for sure. But there's no coordination across the trees. So when you have an index like that, then you have not just one index but multiple indices. And then if you have to do a search, you have to look through each of those indices instead of just one lookup.
Yeah, what I was thinking was something similar to what LevelDB does in its cache, is that before it uses the hash table, they actually have multiple hash tables that it calls, I forget the name, Shatter? Is that
shards.
Shards, like pieces, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you hash into one of those and you insert that one. We could do something like that to slow down, to improve the performance, because you would have one lock by one of these shards.
Well, how about using LevelDB itself?
LevelDB is written in C++.
Mm.
Which is not horrible.
Yeah, but we don't want to deal with that. So.
Yeah.
I don't think we should be spending time on that kind of stuff, porting, if we don't have to. Okay, so we need to think about that. Right, but let's say that there are applications which can make use of this capability if it exists. That is, one thread issues a sync and everyone else
shouldn't be allowed.
Shouldn't be modifying the container while some key operations of the sync happen. Right, such as the discovery and copying of data into persistent.
The discovery would be triggered immediately after you issue a sync point.
Mm-hmm.
So the sync point should be the one that stops everything. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I forgot how we
start. And that is fine. I think we can expect the application would do that coordination. That no thread would progress until one thread finishes at sync point.
So how do we block the other threads when they try
to? We don't have to.
We don't have to?
Because the application will do it. They can assume that the application does it.
Is that safe, Dustin?
It's not safe. I mean, a poorly written application will break. But we can say that here is the spec for this API call, that when you issue a C point, no other thread should be active in modifying the container state at that time. Let's start from there. Let's start simple, and then we can think about whether we want to go further and do something more intrusive. Okay, so let's say that we don't have to worry about it, right? That the threads coordinate amongst themselves so that C points are exclusive to any modifications of the container. So then the next step would be to copy all the...
But if we do that, we don't need thread safety, do we?
We don't need thread safety for the C point operation. But we may need it for other things. I don't know.
I see. So we may need it, like, for instance, for pointer at operation.
Yeah, adding to the list, for instance. We may need it.
Okay.
But even that, I think, can be dealt with using per thread list.
Per thread list?
Yeah. Per thread pointer list. I don't know if that is...
Why per thread pointer list?
So that you don't have to lock. You have to synchronize updates to the list.
The library is not aware of how many threads the application is running.
True, but there should be a way to know that.
But even if we knew that, how do we... We cannot coordinate that, we cannot distribute the work from a thread if we don't modify the function that is being executed in the thread.
Not sure what you're saying. But let's say that there is a single list and there is locking for now. That all the pointer additions are synchronized. And this is just a log, right? A log of all the new pointers that are being added. And eventually they get copied into the list of persistent pointers. Once that copy happens, the lock on the list can be released.
So at least itself could be released. At least itself disappears.
Or the list goes away. Mm-hmm. Yes. And further updates to a new list are possible at that time.
Yes.
Okay.
But we don't want to allow that until we're done with the sync.
Right, correct. That's what I think. Because we also have to copy data from the volatile into the persistent, correct?
Yes. Yes, assuming that we have a discovery as well.
Okay, so then, what is the next step? Discovery.
So you don't want to go through the exercise of having a simple multi-thread application working first? That could potentially trigger the points in which we have to serialize the access?
I was just thinking about going through the whole process of a C point with discovery first. What would need to happen next? I see how the log, the pointer list needs to be copied into persistent memory, and then those are the pointers we would want to discover, right? Additionally, well, starting from the root, we have to discover what is newly being added to the container, and maybe even what is no longer part of the container.
We're missing another part, which is the memory allocations.
That we don't have yet.
We don't have that yet.
Hmm.
We have to track memory allocations. And I know that in Sofien, we
had a tree of allocations.
Not only that, but allocations and pointers where there was a connection between the two. So that when you do free, you know exactly which pointers to remove. And when you file a pointer, you file all the pointers within one allocation first.
You'll probably need that whole infrastructure.
Yes. Yeah, you can improve on that.
So this is a tree of allocations with pointer information, right?
Yeah, well, we have this, it looks like we have some allocations, and every allocation has a list of pointers that belong to it, that fall within that range. So typically, when there's a pointer, I think you try to find the allocation in which that pointer should go, because you shouldn't be initializing a pointer in a region of memory that hasn't been allocated. So they should always have one allocation there.
Yeah.
Unless you're in a stack.
Yeah, I think the stack is a different story which we'll have to revisit again after we do some tracing. So do you think we should... I think the stack optimization comes later. The basic functionality comes first. Okay, so what do you want to do then?
I think I'll just start working on the discovery.
Borrowing the implementation from a previous version, or as much as we can.
Yeah, as much as
we
can.
I think that's a good idea, because we did spend a lot of time optimizing that stuff and choosing the right data structures after a few different possible iterations, right? We did a few iterations and finally said, here's what we need. And I think it's, there's no reason not to start from that point.
I agree.
At least for discovery.
I agree. Yeah. I will start there.
Okay. All right. So now I do want to talk about writing, because we do, you know, when I was at Intel, there were people who were asking me, do you have a document about all of this? And I said, unfortunately, we don't have anything. And I think for us, the document is the paper. And whenever we have something, there are people at Intel who are willing to give us feedback on it.
Right, nobody wants to read the code. It's just too involved.
Yeah, I don't think it's even, you know, it's even fair to ask people to read our code. Because they have their own code to read.
True.
So we have to give them something that's much more descriptive and easier to understand. So I remember we talked about writing up the contributions, and I don't know if you've made any progress with that.
I haven't done anything else about it. Something that would be easy for me to write, it's perhaps a description of how things, small how things work, and maybe how they're glued together, but just like a technical document. Describing the design and the data structures and things like that.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't want us to waste time writing something that we won't write anyway for a paper.
No, I was thinking that to help then get us feedback.
No, I don't want us to waste time doing that.
Okay.
I mean, whatever feedback they're going to give us, it's probably going to be the same if they read a paper of ours as opposed to this technical document, because I don't think they're going to go into details of how things work in hard software. What they're looking for is ideas and maybe some evaluation which might indicate whether our ideas are good or not. But I don't think that if we make a presentation with all those details, like a oral presentation, they might be interested. But a technical document with the details of some piece of software that they won't even use, I don't think it's appealing for them to actually understand it.
I agree. Okay.
And I don't want us to be, I don't want you to be wasting time writing something like that up.
I wouldn't enjoy it either.
Yeah.
Try my hand at it, since I'm going to be going through the code and trying to understand it myself anyways.
Okay, yeah, sure. I think it's good to have it if there is interest in creating it, but I don't think it's priority for us. For you, it might actually be a good idea to just do it anyway. Right. So Leo, what was I going to say? I completely forgot. The discovery is one part which is probably going to take you some time to get it to work with this new implementation of yours, right? Although quite a bit was implemented earlier. I think in the meanwhile, we should spend time brainstorming over the contributions by email if you have something, right? I would really encourage you to think about the paper in the end, as I always say, at the end of your PhD, what really matters is what you have on paper, what you have in published form as a paper. And that's the reality of the situation, right? No matter how much code you write. So the people who are very successful in terms of getting a lot of papers published have the ability to focus on that goal and do the absolutely bare minimum or close to bare minimum necessary to get the paper done. Right? So I think it's important for us to think from that perspective. In any case, we are not building a product. We are just doing what is that called?
Prototype.
Prototype. Yeah, we're just making the case for some idea. And it's up to the industry or whoever is going to make a business out of this to do the actual real work, trying to figure out all the details, what really works, what really does, what doesn't work in great detail. For us, we don't have to do that. We just have to make the case saying that, okay, here's what we did, and this is what you get if you do it our way, right, for these workloads. And we're not changing anything more than that. So that's why it is important to think paper, paper, paper all the time. Right? I would go as far as to say that if you do not know how what you're doing at this moment makes it into some line eventually, a sentence at least, or a paragraph in the paper, then you should probably not be doing it at all. Right? It could be that you're writing code to create an experiment which you'll talk about in the paper. That's fine. But you have to know that there is a good reason for what you're doing because it's going to make it into paper form. Right? Otherwise, don't do it. And then even so, and you're doing something, you say, okay, this is going to lead me to say something specific in the paper. Is there something similar I can say in the paper, or even better, that has a shorter path to getting there? Right, so those kind of questions become important when you have paper in your mind and the forefront of your mind. Right? We all know about this, but it's important to keep reminding ourselves that this is really what we are here for. We are here to challenge the world, to say, okay, here's a new piece of work. Take what you may. This is what we found. And they won't see it unless we write a paper about it. So let's do the brainstorming for the contributions over email. And I think we should start writing some abstract at least for the potential paper. Because right now we don't have anything. You have some technical report somewhere, but I don't know if it's in any form that we can put in a paper, in a submission. And you did that report from Ming's class, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, certainly feel free to salvage anything that you can from that report, and let's have that discussion over the coming week.
Okay. Okay, sounds good.
Okay, good. So let's communicate via email, and Leo, please include Daniel also in the emails, so he's aware of what's going on, as well as Arthur, who's not here today. He wrote to me saying that he is busy moving into his new apartment.
Nice.
So he found one.
Yeah, finally. Okay, great. Anything else?
Yeah, you wanted to mention what exactly, I guess I was included in the invited.
Which one? The
access to the machine.
Yes. The machine access is. They were working on. You already have access.
I already have access, unless they remove.
Okay,
my
so
account.
They said that the kernel sources, which is being built, are so the kernel sources are available to us, but I don't know what we can do with that.
I think it's the same thing that is in GitHub.
No, no. This is the one with the latency emulation. Is that also in the GitHub? If
no.
That's in the GitHub, why would they want... Why is this machine so important to us?
No. It's not in the GitHub, the latency emulation.
Hmm.
I don't think that's part of the system itself. It's something else.
Yeah. No, they gave us a pointer to the kernel. The kernel sources are on that machine, so I don't know why they want to give us access to the kernel sources. I guess we can look at the sources, but we can't do anything more than that, can we?
Yeah, get in trouble for using those ideas.
Yeah. So I don't quite get it. I don't know how this thing works. What kind of stupid idea was this?
If we have the kernel source, can we like copy it and compile it?
No. I don't think we can do that. I mean, if they were wanting to do that, why would they go through all this trouble giving us access to this super important machine? We just make the kernel sources available to us and then go figure it out yourself, right? Maybe there is more to this than just the kernel sources. Maybe it's the platform itself, the machine itself that has something specific. I don't know, like from a hardware standpoint. In any case, we shouldn't be moving any code out of it.
Well, I guess we will only use the machine once we know exactly what experiments we want to run.
Yeah.
Just to get to use the more realistic latencies.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah, and even for that, I think we need to... Yeah, the coordination part is the one that bothers me. I mean, what if other people are also running stuff at the same time? I guess we can communicate with them about that.
Because, plus I know, I think there's only one machine.
Why is that? What is special about this machine? Why can't they put it on 5 different machines and provide access to people on different, more than one machine? So that makes me suspect that maybe there's something special about the hardware itself. Otherwise, it's kind of weird that they would just set up one machine with this kernel.
You'll
find
out
eventually.
It's possible that this simulation...
Or should probably just write an email to those guys asking this question. What were you going to say, sorry?
Now, it's possible that simulating this implementation only works with one specific family of CPUs,
mm-hmm.
Which they have available in that machine, but not in others.
Yeah, I'm kind of, it's interesting. Well, anyway, we'll eventually figure it out. Let's do what we can at our end. And then cross the bridge when we have to.
Alright.
Okay. Alright, guys. Go buy the new iPhones.
I'm trying to get rid of my iPhone.
You are?
So, yeah.
Why is that?
Just too small for me.
Oh, they are the big ones now.
Hello.
You don't